Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Tuesday, April 21st, and this is our deep dive into the Commodities and Energy Edition. I'm Maya, and alongside me, as always, is Alex.
And delighted to be here, Maya. We're tackling some really critical intersections today, pulling apart the forces shaping everything from your morning commute to, frankly, the stability of global systems.
We can trace that further. Let's not bury the lead. We're starting with geopolitical shocks and their immediate ripple effects on crude oil markets. Is $90 a barrel the new normal, or are we looking at another spike?
It's a question of control, isn't it? Like training a falcon, you can shape its instinct, but unpredictable external forces will always demand responsiveness, and the oil market feels very much like that right now. But we're not stopping there.
No, we're also dissecting Apple's future and whether its supply chain can actually handle the next wave of innovation. Seriously, did you know 80% of Apple's assembly happens in just one country?
Incredible statistic. And that's before we get into the sheer power demands of the energy transition. Scaling renewables is amazing, but where are we getting the raw materials and infrastructure to make it happen?
Speaking of demands, finally, we're diving deep into food security and the global fertilizer supply. Turns out, a seemingly innocuous ingredient is becoming a major flashpoint. Alex, you won't believe the knock-on effects.
Oh, I have a feeling I will believe it. Let's get into it.
Bob McNally anticipating high gas prices this summer sounds cheerful. Let's unpack the geopolitical shocks hitting crude oil markets right now, specifically the Iran conflict. Why is this a commodity and energy story, and why should everyone be paying attention?
It's fundamentally about supply disruption and the price elasticity of demand. The ongoing conflict, even with a fragile ceasefire, is injecting a significant risk premium into the crude oil market. While existing tanker traffic is providing a buffer, as Amos Hochstein points out, that's not a sustainable state. The core issue is the potential for escalation and the choke point control Iran exerts over the Strait of Hormuz.
A risk premium. Translation, everyone's guessing how badly things could go, and that guess is adding dollars to the price of a barrel. But the market seems strangely calm. Several strategists, Bloomberg Surveillance reported, are disagreeing on the likely course, indicating potential overoptimism. What's going on with this disconnect?
That disconnect stems from a misunderstanding of logistical lags. Luke Groman highlights this perfectly. Oil successfully transiting today won't impact markets for 6 weeks. This creates an air pocket of scarcity that isn't reflected in current futures pricing. Plus, there's an element of hyperoptimism within the oil industry itself. As Jack McClendon observed, a tendency to overcome cycles, even against the odds.
So everyone's building castles on sand, believing supply will magically reappear, even as Iran is potentially playing a dance in the wordplay, according to Ellen Wald, agreeing to things that mean different things to different people. Specifically, that Strait of Hormuz reopening.
Something to flag here, the Friday miscommunication about the Strait is a prime example. Both sides may be agreeing to different interpretations of what reopening entails. It's not a shared understanding, and President Trump's attempts to project optimism, as Wald pointed out, seem driven by domestic market boosts rather than geopolitical realities, further muddying the waters. This performative tactic, as Sternoff calls the blockade, doesn't change the underlying leverage.
A diplomatic charade fueled by the Dow Jones. Okay. Let's get concrete. Paul Sweeney forecasts oil falling to $80 barrel in the next 3 to 6 months, a positive scenario. Is that realistic or wishful thinking?
Sweeney's $80 barrel forecast hinges on a swift, complete resolution. However, several indicators suggest that's unlikely. Stephen Parker warns that sustained prices at $100 could pressure stocks and bonds, and $120-$140 could trigger a recession. The more realistic scenario based on the available data is prolonged disruption, lasting months and possibly years, particularly impacting Europe and Asia.
Months and possibly years. That's not a relief rally headline. What about China? Everyone talks about China. The Iran waivers piece said the US blockade controls 80% of China's oil supply. Is this as big a lever as it sounds?
It's an unusual level of economic control. Heidi Kreber-Edeker is right. The U.S. isn't just pursuing a trade and critical minerals agenda with China, it's actively constricting their oil access. China's energy strategy, simultaneous investment in renewables, nuclear, coal, and massive reserves, is being validated by this crisis, but even their strategic approach can't completely insulate them from disruption.
Okay, China's prepared, everyone else isn't. That leaves Europe. Sweeney specifically cites energy shocks impacting Europe. What's the story there?
Europe's reliance on Gulf oil makes it particularly vulnerable. The reassessment of trade routes and currency reliance is already underway. Beyond the direct price impact, Sweeney predicts a fundamental reevaluation of the Gulf's business model. It's not simply about commodities anymore, it's about regional stability and alternative supply routes. Gulf states are accelerating investments in pipelines, as Hochstein noted, to bypass the strait.
Pipelines are expensive, slow to build, and don't solve the immediate problem. What about the U.S.? Are we suddenly energy independent and laughing at everyone else?
Not quite. While U.S. energy security has improved due to policies enabled by LNG exports and shale oil, as Hochstein pointed out, it's a more nuanced picture. The shale revolution, Jack McClendon argues, decreased the probability of major conflicts by reducing reliance on unstable sources. But that doesn't mean we're immune. We're now the functional swing supplier, meaning tankers heading our way aren't a sign of strength, but higher demand elsewhere driving up prices.
So we're inadvertently fueling the fire by becoming everyone's backup plan. What's Iran's angle in all of this? Is it purely about money?
The Iran conflict brief suggests it's far more complex. They're seeking reparations for past war damage, potentially proposing a toll system through the strait, an attempt to formalize a precedent for compensation. The proposed $1 to 2 barrel toll isn't primarily about the revenue itself, but establishing that principle.
A symbolic tax on global oil trade. Is this about establishing control, or is it genuinely about the $14 billion a year?
It's about establishing leverage. They're strategically employing calculated irrationality, appearing unpredictable to regain deterrence, as the brief outlines. They recognize a show of reasonability only invites further attacks. More importantly, they're signaling a willingness to formalize their regional proxy network, integrating PMU forces in Iraq into the National Army, an unprecedented shift in decades.
Integrating militias. That sounds messy. And it probably doesn't make things easier for the U.S., which, as Hochstein said, unintentionally created a crisis over the strait to solve another conflict, the Israeli-Lebanese situation.
The current situation is a manufactured problem attempting to resolve an existing one. The two-week ceasefire deadline is approaching, contingent on sustained tanker traffic, but a temporary deal doesn't guarantee long-term stability. Iran is unlikely to relinquish strategic control of the waterway, opting for a fig leaf of open access while maintaining operational control.
A fig leaf of access controlled by Iran. Wonderful. So what about the physical market? Are we seeing actual shortages, or is it all just futures speculation?
Luke Grohman highlights a crucial point. The market's reaction to crises lags significantly, approximately 3 weeks for oil currently in transit. This creates a deceptive sense of immediate impact or lack thereof. There's a disconnect between futures pricing and the real-world availability. HSBC's CEO, quoting $286 barrel deliveries, emphasizes the potential for extreme price spikes.
$286 barrel deliveries. Okay, that's terrifying. What's the role of tanker traffic? Is it a useful metric, or are we looking at the wrong things?
Tanker counts are misleading. Grohman argues that the actual volume of oil transiting is more important. He also points out credible reports of targeted strikes on U.S. infrastructure, embassies, fleet bases, contradicting official narratives. The conflict is likely longer and more damaging than widely believed.
Targeted strikes on U.S. infrastructure? That's not exactly a calming thought. What about the fertilizer angle? I keep seeing that pop up.
The fertilizer shortage, tied to the Hormuz closure and the Northern Hemisphere growing season, could trigger a population-level crisis. Grohman references data showing that only 3.9 billion people could be supported without synthetic fertilizer, compared to 7.5 billion currently. The fragility of food supply is extreme.
So geopolitical tensions translate into empty stomachs. What does all of this mean for the U.S. domestic political landscape?
Grohman predicts a potential blue wave in the midterms due to soaring food and gas inflation, connecting geopolitical risk directly to domestic outcomes. It's a second-order effect rarely considered in standard market forecasts.
All right, let's try to pull all this together. We've got a fragile ceasefire, a lot of uncertainty, logistical lags, Iran playing a long game, and the potential for a major supply shock. What's the most likely scenario over the next few months?
Based on the available data, a gradual escalation of tension is the most probable outcome. While a complete closure of the strait remains unlikely, sustained disruptions will continue, leading to localized price spikes and regional instability. The market's perception of resolution is dangerous. The actual disruption hasn't started yet.
And that's where we make our bet. Alex, I predict that WTI crude oil will exceed $95 per barrel by July 21st, 2026, driven by the delayed impact of the Hormuz disruptions and Iran's continued leverage. What say you?
I'll take the under. I believe that a partial deal will emerge by then, allowing for a resumption of flows, even if limited, keeping WTI below $90. The key will be monitoring actual oil volume transiting the strait, not just ship counts, and focusing on the MTO sector in China for signs of demand destruction. Let's revisit this on July 21st.
Excellent. Because this entire crisis, as Amos Hochstein frames it, is fundamentally intertwined with national and economic security, and understanding those energy dynamics is now essential. But it also reminds me that even if we sort this mess out, the underlying technical issues remain, from a reliance on increasingly expensive infrastructure to the fundamental economic pressures building in China, and that's precisely where we'll pick up next. We're shifting gears to Apple's future and the tech supply chain. $100 billion. That's the free cash flow Apple's hardware engine generates, and it's why today's CEO announcement, Tim Cook to chairman John Ternus taking the helm, isn't about personality, it's about protecting a commodities pipeline.
Hardware isn't just a driver for Apple, it is the driver, and Ternus's deep hardware expertise is now directly in charge of preserving that $100 billion stream. Cook's legacy is undeniably operational, especially his supply chain mastery, and the fact he's moving to an executive chairman role explicitly focused on international relations and supply chain oversight underscores its continuing importance.
Supply chain isn't sexy, but Cook built a fortress around it. And if we're honest, a lot of investor enthusiasm around tech companies lately feels like faith in a vaguely defined AI magic, overlooking the very real-world constraints of, say, rare earth mineral sourcing.
It's a telling detail, which is where Ternus's appointment becomes particularly interesting. The expansion of his responsibilities to include a secretive robotics unit isn't about building Roomba competitors, it's about control. Control over design, control over manufacturing, and crucially, control over the infrastructure needed to consume AI, specifically LLMs.
LLMs, let's break that down. Apple's apparently betting they can disrupt the current AI paradigm by optimizing hardware for LLM consumption and bypassing the cloud-based data center model. If true, that changes everything.
It would. The current AI build-out, as Luschini points out, is already seeing substantial spending and shows no signs of slowing, suggesting this isn't a fleeting cycle. If Apple can create a truly efficient on-device LLM experience, it essentially becomes the gatekeeper to a fundamentally different type of AI access.
And the risk of being left behind is substantial. Experts are already forecasting a path similar to Amazon and Microsoft, strategic acquisitions of external AI companies like Anthropic or Perplexity.
Which makes perfect sense, really. Internal R&D is vital, but accelerating AI development requires a broad portfolio. The current market isn't valuing companies on potential alone. It's rewarding those who can demonstrate tangible progress in the AI space. Apple's financial position allows it to essentially buy its way to the front of the line.
So hardware first, supply chain secure, and AI purchased as necessary. That feels a bit un-Apple.
Not entirely. Think of Apple's future strategy as a complex game of risk. They've secured their core territories, the premium hardware market, and its associated ecosystem. Now they're strategically reinforcing key fronts, AI, and preparing for a potential invasion from competitors. The acquisitions aren't about abandoning internal innovation. They're about rapid expansion and securing strategic resources before others do.
I see. Let's talk Netflix for a moment because it's a useful counterpoint. They're also leaning into AI, but their valuation is now more dependent on predictable and consistent business performance, stability, and content search. Apple is already stable. They're using AI to unlock the next growth phase, not fix a broken model.
Worth noting, Netflix's optionality is tied to leveraging AI to optimize content spending, driving earnings per share. Apple, however, has the luxury of experimentation. They can afford to invest aggressively in disruptive technologies like on-device LLMs without jeopardizing their existing revenue streams.
Which brings us back to SpaceX and Elon Musk. It's a completely different model, right? Valuation isn't tied to current earnings, it's driven by a continuous narrative shift from rockets to high-growth future markets like data centers in space.
And that narrative is intentionally fueled by a magic pot of money, the AI investment frenzy. Musk isn't building a space conglomerate for the sake of space exploration. He's creating a financial vehicle to raise capital for increasingly ambitious projects. This illustrates the importance of perception and the power of continually evolving a company's horizon of possibilities.
Apple's moving from a core territory defense to an horizon of possibilities expansion, but with a much more conservative approach. Less data centers in space, more well better iPhones.
Not just better iPhones. It's about a fundamentally new hardware form factor optimized for LLM consumption, potentially bypassing the limitations of cloud infrastructure. They're quietly building the foundation for a post-cloud AI ecosystem, and their control over the supply chain is the key differentiator.
Okay, let's talk consequences. If Apple doesn't execute, we're looking at slightly slower iPhone sales. If their AI strategy falters, we're looking at a slightly more aggressive services push. But if their robotics unit accidentally creates a self-aware cleaning bot uprising, well, that's a problem.
A very specific problem. But seriously, the signal to watch isn't product announcements, it's Apple's capital allocation.
Agreed. Keep an eye on the next quarterly earnings report scheduled for July 31st. Specifically, watch for any significant increases in R&D spending related to LLMs or robotics, and any announcements of acquisitions in the AI space. That's where the real story will be told.
And it will speak directly to their ability to navigate this increasingly complex commodities and energy landscape, the insatiable demand for processing power, the sourcing of critical minerals, and the logistical challenges of securing a truly global supply chain. Because ultimately, AI isn't just about algorithms, it's about the physical infrastructure that supports it.
You know what I noticed this week? Capacity auction prices are apparently behaving like lottery tickets.
There's a signal here, the shift in prioritization we're seeing, from sustainability metrics like Scope 1, 2, and 3 reductions to simply securing reliable power, is fundamentally reshaping the energy market, and those auction results, especially in PJM, are a clear indicator. Gerard Reed and Lawrence Segalin highlighted this perfectly in their analysis of U.S. utilities and hyperscaler strategies.
Hyperscalers. It's a fantastic name for entities consuming power at the scale of small countries.
Indeed.
Their demand isn't just a factor, it's the factor. They're not just signing PPAs, they're directly investing in generation gas-fired plants in the southern U.S., no less despite public net-zero commitments. Meta's 7 GW CCGT project in Louisiana is the most visible example of this immediate need, overriding long-term goals.
So net-zero pledges are optional?
Not optional, but clearly secondary to operational requirements. The core issue is 24/7 reliability. Constellation understands this perfectly, and their acquisition of Calpine wasn't about expansion. It was about diversifying to cover that base load, recognizing nuclear power alone couldn't handle the escalating demand.
Calpine? Gas? Aren't we supposed to be leaving gas behind?
The irony isn't lost on anyone. But gas provides the flexibility needed to integrate renewables, and Constellation's fleet is the largest in the U.S. However, the load factors on those plants do need improvement. Maximizing their efficiency is critical for the overall economic equation.
Constellation is essentially betting on keeping the lights on for Google, and the market is rewarding them with 30-year high valuations.
Two things stand out. Their strategy isn't innovative technology. It's maximizing the value of existing nuclear assets by capitalizing on hyperscaler demand. Tracking those long-term power purchase agreements with Microsoft, Google drives up capacity factors and justifies the premium valuations. It's a very calculated move.
A utility's worth is now measured by how well it can attract data centers.
That's a simplification, but the market perception is largely driven by the belief that capacity factors will increase. This, in turn, is directly tied to securing those hyperscaler contracts. It suggests a potential disconnect between market optimism and the pace of actual decarbonization.
Xavier Vaillard talked about hourly volatility in European markets. Is that a parallel we should be expecting here?
Stepping back, the increasing penetration of renewables inherently creates price fluctuations. German markets saw prices swing from 160 euros to 0 euros to 80 euros within a single day. That predictable hourly volatility is an arbitrage opportunity for battery storage, but it also adds complexity. We're already seeing that in CAISO, with day-ahead price standard deviation tripling between 2023 to 2025.
The grid is becoming a really complicated trading game.
It is becoming more dynamic, but it's layered. There's predictable hourly volatility driven by renewable output, overlaid on broader fluctuations from weather and commodity prices. Effective risk management requires understanding both levels.
Europe also seems to be realizing that sovereignty trumps sustainability.
Vaillard frames it as a fundamental shift in the energy trilemma. Security is now the priority. That's leading to increased government intervention to secure supply chains and diversify commodities, even if it means contradicting free market principles. Individual countries are diverging, France investing in nuclear, Germany in renewables, balanced through interconnection capacity.
It feels like everyone wants productive energy access. As Rajiv Shah put it, the 1,000 kWh threshold, but we're building a system optimized for data centers.
There's a clear imbalance. The focus on hyperscalers and developed markets is driving infrastructure investment in a way that doesn't necessarily address the needs of the 2 billion people lacking adequate power. Shah highlighted the failures of traditional utility reform in countries like Nigeria, with a more viable path involving distributed renewables.
Grid redefined as a network of smaller investors selling back excess power, it sounds almost hopeful.
It's a pragmatic shift. The traditional model of centralized utilities is demonstrably failing in many contexts. The U.S. focusing on technology while ignoring the political economy of energy in countries like Nigeria is a core obstacle to progress.
The UN's 150 kWh benchmark is basically a participation trophy.
Effectively, it doesn't unlock economic opportunity. The farmers' cooperative in Uttar Pradesh, India, saw a tenfold income increase with reliable solar power. That's the scale of impact productive energy access delivers.
I'm sitting here picturing data centers and farmers competing for the same electrons, and honestly, it feels profoundly ridiculous.
It is, on a certain level, a misallocation of resources. In macroeconomic risks, currency fluctuations are a significant, often overlooked barrier to private investment in developing countries. Incentivizing local currency investment is critical.
Okay, so we've got hyperscalers driving up demand, gas reluctantly sticking around, nuclear getting a second look, grids getting incredibly complex, and a definition of access that's functionally useless. What's the one question we haven't answered?
Honestly, how do we reconcile the immediate need for reliable power, driven by those hyperscaler demands, with the long-term systemic changes required for a truly equitable and sustainable energy transition, and the cost implications of doing both? That's the fundamental tension.
Right up. And given the current rate of geopolitical instability, that tension is about to get significantly more interesting, because that's precisely what's going to drive food security concerns. 3 million tons of urea vanished. That's a pretty stark number to start with. Let's unpack the global fertilizer situation and its impact on food security, a commodities and energy issue if ever there was one.
The removal of that urea supply, largely due to the Middle East conflict, has pushed prices back to 2022 levels. But the core problem isn't necessarily facility damage, it's logistical. Specifically, 2.7 million tons are currently stuck due to issues around the Strait of Hormuz. And even inland, trucking in Saudi Arabia is adding $100 a ton to phosphate export costs from Yanbu.
$100 a ton just to move it? That's significant. It's less about bombs and more about bottlenecks then.
The implication runs deeper, it extends beyond urea. Major phosphate exporters China, Russia, Morocco, India are facing curtailments. We're seeing a fascinating duality with India. Demand is inelastic, propped up by government subsidies, while markets without subsidies are experiencing demand destruction.
A two-tiered market, essentially. So the big question is whether India can maintain its consumption rate. And what about Ukraine's?
Ukraine is a critical piece. The reports from the crop tour suggest 20 to 30% of farmers are lacking supplies and may skip applications altogether. The black soil offers some buffer, but only with favorable weather. It's a precarious dependency.
Favorable weather as a supply chain solution. That's optimistic, bordering on delusional.
It is, and it highlights a key vulnerability often overlooked. Romania, for example, isn't just worried about overall yields. Later stage nitrogen applications are crucial for maintaining high protein wheat, 12.5% protein content. Skipping those applications could threaten their premium pricing, even if the total harvest is acceptable.
So it's not just if crops grow, but how they grow. Quality matters. What's the bigger trend here?
The market is shifting from reacting to geopolitical headlines to granular operational data, specifically vessel movements through the Hormuz Strait. Participants are seemingly ignoring the headlines and focusing on concrete flows. Each day of blocked transit ratchets up price expectations.
Minihan's point about waiting for 20 vessels to move, that's a weirdly passive response to a global crisis.
It signifies a breakdown of traditional macro-level analysis. And Russia is uniquely positioned to benefit, leveraging its domestic sulfur and ammonia supplies to potentially increase Baltic DAP and MAP prices, essentially filling the gaps created by the disruptions elsewhere.
Convenient. So where does this leave us looking forward, say, by the end of the planting season?
I expect continued price volatility, heavily influenced by logistical realities in the Red Sea and, critically, China's internal sulfur constraints. Their export restrictions on TSP and SSP will continue impacting Brazil and other importers. We need to watch the movement of those 20 vessels, but even more broadly, the systemic weakness in India's fertilizer supply chain, a squeeze on both raw material imports and finished product sourcing, represents a significant long-term risk.
Stepping back from the specifics, $90 oil, Apple's relentless push for control, data centers guzzling fossil fuels, and a fertilizer crisis threatening food supply, it feels like we've been dissecting different symptoms of the same underlying illness. A systemic fragility, exacerbated by a world operating with mismatched priorities, wouldn't you say? It's not just individual bottlenecks, but a cascade effect.
Consider this. I think what's particularly insidious is the illusion of control we keep constructing. We saw it in the oil market, where a temporary logistical tightening created a substantial risk premium detached from physical fundamentals. We see it with Apple attempting to build a vertically integrated fortress against supply chain disruption, which, while rational, doesn't solve the foundational issue of resource competition. It's a re-regionalization of risk, not elimination.
And that idea of mismatched priorities is everywhere. Hyperscalers needing reliable power now driving investment in, ironically, the very infrastructure the long-term energy transition is trying to dismantle. That 160 euros to 0 euros to 80 euros swing in German markets felt like a visceral illustration of that tension. It's like we're building castles on sand, expecting sustainable outcomes from inherently unstable foundations.
It's a potent analogy, Maya. And that instability isn't just economic. We're operating in a geopolitical environment where clarity is actively suppressed. Think about the $1 to 2 barrel toll proposed for the Strait of Hormuz, a calculated irrationality, potentially a performative tactic, but one that forces a reevaluation of baseline costs and access. The 80% of China's oil supply potentially under US influence, these aren't isolated incidents. They're maneuvers in a larger game, and the disconnect between futures pricing and the granular operational data we discussed is telling.
And Apple's $100 billion engine feels like a direct response to that game. Bet on design, manufacturing, and AI infrastructure as the ultimate form of leverage. But even their immense financial capacity doesn't guarantee insulation. Their 80% assembly in a single country represents a new point of vulnerability, one that requires constant, proactive mitigation.
Here's the picture of the fertilizer situation. Those 3 million tons vanished. Trucking costs hitting $100 ton in Saudi Arabia reveals the real-world consequences of these systemic weaknesses. 7.5 billion people supported by synthetic fertilizer, only 3.9 billion without it. It's not a future problem, it's a present crisis. Perhaps, as Stephen Parker pointed out, $120-$140 oil isn't just a market forecast, but a potential trigger.
So what do we watch? I think it comes down to WTI exceeding $95 by July 2026, specifically predicated on the Hormuz Strait delays. And Apple's next earnings report on July 31st, increases in R&D spending and AI acquisitions will be a crucial signal.
I agree. And perhaps more importantly, we need to pay attention to the underlying tension. Can we reconcile short-term operational needs with long-term sustainability goals? It feels like we're navigating a complex maritime route shrouded in fog where the currents are unpredictable and the charts are constantly being redrawn.
And truthfully, a lot hinges on factors outside of anyone's control. Ukraine's crop yields, China's long-term strategy, Iran's true intentions.
It's a sobering thought.
It is.
Thanks for joining us this week as we unpack the complexities of commodities and energy. We'll be back next week with a fresh set of challenges.